Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by John Cross of the Daily Mirror and Don Fifield of The Guardian. News just in. A fascinating Champions League draw sends Jurgen Klopp back to Germany to face Bayern Munich. Spurs have a tough task against Dortmund, but City should have little trouble with Schalke. United play PSG. I suppose the question is, John, will Jose Mourinho be their manager in mid-Feb?
Well, I have to say it is a debating point because how much worse can it get? I think he will be. And I think the very fact is that basically what's keeping him in a job at the moment is the fact that he's in the Champions League knockout stages. Because I think that Man United will make a decision, I think, and have a decision to make when they are A, out of the running for the top four, but also, I think, coupled with that, because it's hard to see them, let's be honest, making next season's Champions League on that, but also when they're out of this season's Champions League. And so that draw has not done him any favours whatsoever. I mean, the negativity, the overwhelming negativity coming out of Old Trafford at the moment must be inhibiting, I think, for the team, the squad. And let's be honest, Mourinho is doing very, very little to lift the mood. I mean, you know, that shows in the performances, that shows in some of the players that he's leaving on the bench with Pogba, for example. But the Champions League, let's be clear about this, that is the barometer by which I think that Mourinho is judged. As long as they're in the top four, I think he stays in a job. But they're not. As long as they're in that competition, he stays in a job. So I do think that this, you cannot underestimate the size of this game for Mourinho, and let's be honest, they would be rank outsiders on form right now.
Yeah, you've got to fancy PSG in this one, haven't you?
Yeah, the whole thought of Neymar and Mbappe and even Cavani running at that United defence at the moment is fairly terrifying. That's a dreadful draw. I mean, Mourinho he's had good and bad moments against PSG with Chelsea over the years, the new PSG, I mean, but this is a daunting task. I mean, when an English club draws PSG, the one thing that sort of bolsters them is the fact that PSG aren't tested on a weekly basis in Ligue 1. And I think they've dropped 4 points all season in the top, French top flight. But the reality is I don't think United have got A, the confidence, and B, possibly the armoury to hurt them at the moment. And then you're sort of relying upon Mourinho doing something old-style Jose tactically to stifle PSG, but with Mbappe and Neymar, that's quite a task. The irony of it all is that if United had dropped into the Europa League and finished third in their Champions League qualifying group, they probably have a better chance of qualifying for the next season's Champions League, which, I mean, it's got to that stage now. And it's sad to see, to be honest.
You know, if we've got a European theme here, obviously the job of a sporting director is very well established in Europe. But even in the Premier League, I think it's only four clubs who haven't got a sporting director or the equivalent of obviously Manchester United is one. Is that indicative of a club which has almost become complacent and allowed itself to be left behind?
Yes. And I also think it's incredibly interesting and telling that we've been talking about this for the best part of a year or so. You know, the debate has obviously been raging, do United need one for much longer? But it's been an intense issue and talking point for that period of time, saying that United need one. And yet here we are further down the line and we still haven't got one. I mean, you know, I think Paul Joyce in The Times wrote a really good piece this weekend sort of highlighting just how much the difference that Michael Edwards has made, for example, at Liverpool, and how much, you know, envy there must be at Man United for someone who has been so creative with some deals, you know, with some contracts and some transfers. And United just don't have that. I mean, you look at Everton. Everton have sort of re-entered the market with Brands, for example. And then, therefore, they have someone who's got an overall picture. And it makes me think, if this has been a debating point for so long, why hasn't it been resolved? And you have to say that I would argue that some of it must revolve around the long-term uncertainty surrounding the manager. Because in an ideal world, you would choose a sporting director or director of football who works independently on his own, is good enough to carry off that role. But similarly, a lot of other clubs feel that it's something that's got to be in tandem with the manager. And if you don't quite know the manager and his long-term prospects, then maybe it's not the best time to appoint a sporting director with the manager, let's be honest, and his future up in limbo.
Yeah, you saw Mourinho at Chelsea, you know, very, very close, Dom. What was his relationship like with Michael Emanalo? You know, he's obviously left.
I think it was relatively functional. I think his relationship with Avram Grant back in the day was probably far more dysfunctional. He reluctantly accepted that he wasn't going to have complete say on all transfers. But he did influence heavily the first team players that came into the squad. I mean, talking largely second time round at Chelsea, I remember at the end of his first season, he'd sort of gone through with Samuel Eto'o and Fernando Torres and Demba Ba as his three strikers. And from January onwards, he was starting to make noises about, no, we can't have this. We can't go on like this. We're not going to achieve anything with this level of striker. And he worked in tandem with Michael Emanalo and Jorge Mendes to get Diego Costa over the line that summer. And Kir Jarabchin was involved as well. I mean, Chelsea's a strange club in as much as it works with very particular agents at any one time to get what they want as the first team squad and what the head coach would want as well. With United, hindsight's wonderful, isn't it? But had they appointed a sporting director going into Sir Alex Ferguson's last season, none of this might have happened. I mean, they might have adjusted better to life after Sir Alex. But I think just because of the peculiarities of somebody who'd been at the club for so long and achieved so much and was all powerful there, as soon as he left, it left a void, and they've attempted to plug it as best they can. They've now got a manager in place who ideally would like not to be working with a sporting director, but football's moved on. Mm. You need that.
Yeah, Jurgen Klopp works within the system, although he's the dominant personality within the football club. You know, that defeat of Manchester United pretty much summed up where both of those clubs are. What will this draw tell us about Liverpool? Liverpool Bayern Munich's got a fantastic ring about it, hasn't it?
It has. What I would argue is right now, I mean, it's difficult to predict because Bayern Munich have still got some wonderful players, but, you know, they're not having a vintage season by any means. And the way that the sort of the conceded goals and were taken apart a little bit in the Champions League group stages, and thinking particularly with Ajax, for example, makes you think they're incredibly vulnerable. And I think that Klopp will have a fantastic insight in exactly what kind of, you know, Bayern's strengths and weaknesses are. And I think he will relish this because he had such, you know, rivalries when he was Dortmund manager, didn't he, that with Bayern, you know, going right to the Champions League final, of course. And, you know, he will love this tie. I think that any team right now will not want to be facing Liverpool in the form and the rampant energy that they're showing. I think that they will feel that Liverpool would be favourites in this. We shouldn't knock their pedigree either, because even though Bayern are a superpower, Liverpool were beaten finalists the year just gone. And basically, the atmosphere and spirit at Anfield can blow opponents away. It really can. It can be overwhelming.
It does galvanise people there, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. God, I was lucky enough to be covering Liverpool for 6-7 years. Two Champions League finals in that time, 05 and 07. And I remember the Olympiacos game, the noise, Anfield Olympiacos game, when they had to win by two clear goals and were 1-0 down at half-time, won 3-1 in stoppage time at the end. An astonishing atmosphere. Then you went through the Juventus match, the Chelsea games. They were incredible, incredible nights at Anfield. It comes with the romance. But look, Klopp went through his Dortmund days as the underdogs against Bayern Munich and did brilliantly well, won a league, competed
with them. He'll go into this tie as favourites. Liverpool will be favourites going into that match against Bayern Munich. And that really tells you quite a lot about the progress that Klopp has instigated at Liverpool.
Mm. You saw Andrew Robertson a couple of weeks ago, John. It was interesting that Mourinho sort of cited him as an example of how and why United were overrun at Anfield at the weekend. He's absolutely fitted in there perfectly, isn't he?
Oh, it's just absolutely fantastic. He epitomises what a manager will want in a player. So basically, it was pretty unspectacular signing. He was even laughing that basically, you know, kind of in the summer, I arrived in the summer when Mo Salah arrived. So basically, when I didn't get straight in the team, no one really noticed, to be honest. And yet you notice him now, right? Because his energy and his power down that left-hand side is phenomenal. I mean, Mourinho was sort of kind of, you know, referring to that energy and making him even feel tired. I mean, that's some compliment, really, because Mourinho's not always the best loser, let's be honest. Mm. And so to highlight the form and the performance of an outstanding player. But he's just a brilliant outlet. He's improved defensively. He's a fantastic story in that basically he's improved so much on his crossing, I think. He came in from Hull, got rejected from Celtic for being too small at 15. He's had these knockbacks in his time. He never, ever gives up. And he's come from, you know, sort of setback after setback, relegated with Hull. Next thing he's at Liverpool. And he's just absolutely sensational. He grasped that opportunity when injuries sort of gave him the way in just over almost exactly, you know, 12 months ago. And he's just never looked back. It's now difficult to imagine a Liverpool team without Robertson at left back. He has got all the qualities, I think, in my view, to be a Liverpool legend and also be a Liverpool captain of the future, because he's got real leadership qualities. Fantastic guy.
Another intriguing tie is the Spurs Borussia Dortmund. We'll look at Spurs maybe a little bit later if we could, but Dortmund, I remember talking to an analyst about 2 years ago where he said the manager you've got to look out for in Europe is Lucien Favre. His underlying stats are amazing and he'll get a big club at some stage. He's doing brilliantly at Dortmund. I think, well, they're 7 points ahead in the Bundesliga. Spurs couldn't have had a harder task here, could they?
Yeah, it's really tough. That's really tough. Favre was at Nice for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And Dico, I spoke to Jean-Michel Seri about him few months back, and he was talking quite highly of him, in fairness, and Claude Puel at Nice, and the impact they both had on that team that was, budgetary wise, it should have been about 13th or 14th in Ligue 1, but actually finished 4th, 5th, 6th in that sort of region, which is quite an achievement. But he's got them ticking. There's a rhythm about them at Dortmund at the moment. Our focus is always drawn towards Jadon Sancho. I mean, just because it's so refreshing to see a young English talent tearing it up to that extent at a big, you know, a major European power. And what he's achieved in the Bundesliga so far since going over from City, really since January time in this calendar year, is something else. He's added goals to his game now as well. But and in fairness, he's eclipsing someone like Pulisic, who is being tipped as a £60 million player for some reason. And you know, coming to England, well, Sancho is keeping him out the side effectively over there, or certainly taking the limelight off Pulisic. So it's a really tough one. A lot of pace, a lot of power about that team, and much will depend upon what state Spurs are in going into that tie. You know, are they still in contention for the Premier League? Are they still in safely ensconced in the top four? I mean, they should be in the top four, but they may have dropped away possibly from the top two by then, in which case, can they concentrate on getting past Dortmund?
Yeah, and continuing the German theme, John, City have got Schalke. Schalke, decent defence, can't score, basically. Mm. You should think that City would be all right there?
I honestly looked at the possible draws for City sort of last night, and basically I thought Schalke was the most favourable. So, you know, I do think that they should beat Schalke at the moment. And that's in no way snobbish about sort of German football, because, you know, you've got some really strong teams there, and sort of Dortmund, I would, you know, argue probably just ahead of Spurs as sort of favourites. But I just think City, being the position that they are in now, absolutely dominant in English football as compared to, you know, sort of the status of Schalke right now, you'd have to make Guardiola's men absolute strong favourites for that one. I can only see him reaching the quarterfinals again.
Mm. And as a sort of a summary, really, the last couple of ties which stand out to me, Atletico, Juventus, you know, Ronaldo going back to Madrid, and Lyon, Barcelona.
Yeah, Lyon have got a lot of very good, talented young players who shone against City in the group stage. But you look at them, and I suspect, I mean, this will, Barcelona will come through this tie, but Lyon could, you know, could make it difficult for them in France, potentially. It's another opportunity for the likes of Fekir to show what they can do, to showcase, and some of their younger talent as well. But yeah, the one that Atletico Juventus, I don't suppose there'll be a lot of goals. It could be quite dour, but I just wonder whether that's the type of occasion and tie that Ronaldo just shines in and edges the Italian club through.
So, John, now for something completely different. League Cup quarterfinals. I suppose that begs the question, can City, who are at Leicester on Tuesday, win four trophies?
I think they can, yes. I think whether they will or not is the bigger question. I do think that basically last season, the sheer number of games weighed Pep Guardiola's side down. I mean, listen, I tipped Liverpool for the title before the start of the season, and that's it's looking quite good now. But I have to say, I just think I've been blown away by City and some of their performances. When they hit the heights, I still think they are probably the best team in the Premier League and will take some stopping. It's a question of whether they can balance that whole Champions League demands. Obviously, we're just about to run into the FA Cup as well. But having won it last season, I just get the feeling sometimes Pep Guardiola will sort of kind of seize upon that and say, look, this is the challenge for some of those fringe players, because he does tend to rest and rotate through that competition. Mm. We all know about the depth of quality that they have, some of the outstanding youngsters that they have. And I think it's a challenge that I think he'll be desperate, I think, to really take up. I would make them favourites to go through against Leicester, and once you're into the semi-finals, then I do think no one would want to face City.
Mm, yeah, Pep's been talking about Phil Foden as a diamond. We don't see it very often, do we, that diamond? Do you think this is the sort of competition that he can actually blood him in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is an opportunity for Foden, fresh from his nice new long-term contract. He will get more game time over time, but yeah, we're desperate to sort of see more of him on the pitch. Maybe Diaz as well might get a run out. De Bruyne is the one who needs the time on the pitch, so I'd expect him to play some part. Leicester's a difficult one, in as much as obviously the circumstances around the club, you have to give them a lot of leeway with their performances of late. And they actually went through quite a long unbeaten run without winning many games, but they were unbeaten for a while. The last few performances have been pretty poor. I mean, desperate at Palace at the weekend. And maybe this will get their juices flowing. Maybe it's a sort of occasion they'll rise for. But I just wonder whether if the situation had been different with what happened at Leicester City with the chairman, I wonder whether Claude Puel's job might be under more scrutiny at the moment. He's obviously got them through a difficult period, so you want to give him the time.
And let's be honest, it's a special case, isn't it?
Absolutely, completely. But they look like a team that should be finishing comfortably in the top 10. And I think some of the performances of late have sort of tailed off a bit. But, you know, as you say, you give them leeway. It must be emotionally draining what they've been through. Maybe that's sort of built up over time. They just hit a wall, which is understandable.
Mm. With City, I think the sort of frightening thing about watching at the moment, you're actually seeing players play themselves into form. You know, Gabriel Jesus was a really good case in point at the weekend. That's where the squad depth comes in, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and it's sort of a big opportunity. I mean, bearing in mind, obviously, you're seeing Aguero now back to maybe fitness and sort of kind of back pushing for a starting place. Because you see, Gabriel Jesus at Watford a couple of weeks ago wasn't quite there and basically just needed those extra games. Now, in a normal case, he just wouldn't get that at City, wouldn't get that luxury, would he, really? Mm. But he looks so sharp and he looks so dynamic in that win over Everton. And all of a sudden, you are getting that opportunity. They have got this incredible rich depth of player, you know, City. City evolve, I think, as a team, don't they? I mean, signing Mahrez in the summer, we wondered sort of kind of where Mahrez was going to fit in. You know, and Sane then has a difficult start to the season and he's playing back into form. You know, Sterling has come through an incredible sort of last 10 days or so again to shine. And they've got so many options in so many different areas. Mm. And I think that, you know, real sort of push for places and competition right throughout, because you look at it defensively. One area I guess we'd look at is maybe the goalkeeper. But basically, you know, defensively they're so strong, you know, midfield. Yeah. Every aspect is covered.
But they've got the power to add, haven't they, Dom? And that's the thing, you know, there's talk about Koulibaly coming in as a centre-half. Well,
are we going to get to the stage where they, you know, they've almost one either got too many good players or two they're going to be too good for the common good?
I think you could argue that already. I think they don't need a Koulibaly. I mean, Otamendi's already had a look in this season and he was one of their best standout players last year. And the fact they've got so many good chances, I mean, they're in a situation with Diaz's contract as well where they're worried about losing some of the best talent they've had. They've seen Sancho go off. OK, they've done well with Foden to tie him down, but they have to offer some kind of pathway into the first team setup. They keep bringing in players, even mid-season. I think the logjam in there will start having an effect on those youngsters. They have the clout, you're right. They can go and do what they want in January. They can go and do what they want in the summer. There's no issue in terms of the amount of spending they can implement. But I think Pep is brighter than that. I think he's actually looking more long-term than that. And I think if he sees talent coming through that deserves an opportunity in the first team, he'd rather go that route than just chucking money at it and bringing players in for players' sake.
Mm. Well, and you look at Spurs, for instance, you know, also in the Champions League. Case in point of the weekend with Oliver Skip making his debut, youngest since Gareth Bale in, I think, October 2007. With Pochettino in charge, the thing that you're talking about, the principle you're talking about, Dom, does apply at Spurs, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, it was amazing last week. I was in Barcelona to see them play in the Nou Camp and he put in Kyle Walker-Peters. And, OK, we could talk all day about kind of the Kyle Walker-Peters mistake in the build-up to Dembele's goal. But what he said about him beforehand, Pochettino, was the thing that really caught my attention, and which was basically saying, we believe in this player. Whatever happens tomorrow night, he's going to be one for the future. I believe in him. He's got such a great future. It must make the player feel 10 feet tall, knowing that, the, you know, if mistake comes, which it did, that basically that doesn't mean his Spurs career is over. And it gives a player confidence to go out and play. You know, I know that they, you know, speaking to people behind the scenes at Spurs, they've got a lot of promise and hope for Skip in particular and, you know, really feel that he can go places. But Pochettino just has this way with young players that makes him the sort of the outstanding sort of coach in Premier League terms of developing young English talent and giving those players that opportunity, but also giving them a confidence. They're not going to be just dipped in and out and not so desperate to kind of make a mark that they inevitably fail because they put almost too much pressure on themselves. Mm. So he makes those players feel relaxed. They know that their chances will come over and over again under Pochettino.
I don't mean it's in any disrespect to either club, but are Tottenham almost like the anti-City? The mirror image of them in terms of, you know, they've created a team. I think the net transfer spend something like 29 million over 3 or 4 years. You've got a manager who trusts youth. You've got infrastructure being looked at, training ground, new stadium.
I think it might be a bit simplistic to say, you know, the antithesis of everything that's been done because Pep Guardiola does trust youth as well. I mean, he does play younger players. Mm.
And both managers make players better on the training.
Yeah, absolutely. On that respect, you have to... Yeah, that was absolutely right. Pochettino has improved all the players that he's worked with. They have worked within their budgets. Pochettino has worked within the budgets of the club. The club is looking forward to going into the new arena. Maybe once that is established and they're there and installed there, then they will be able to operate in a slightly different sphere in the transfer market, potentially when the, you know, match day revenues have gone up. They'll be able to offer more wages to more players. Obviously, we know they're stellar players at the moment, now. But I think there's a sort of long-term vision in that. The City, after that first season under Pep Guardiola, realised that to achieve what he wanted to achieve, they needed to spend big. They spent £200 million in the summer of 2017 and that created this team which blew everybody away last year. And they progressed on from that. Spurs could be in that position, but in a few years' time.
I think it's a big season for Spurs because I think Pochettino has proved himself to be one of the outstanding managers in Europe. And I just feel... I think there are going to be two obvious vacancies next summer.
Yeah.
Real Madrid, Manchester United. And I would imagine that Pochettino will be top of both of those clubs' lists. Mm. And I think that basically, even though he signed a new contract, five-year contract for a lot of money, big contract at Spurs, over £8 million a season, Pochettino last summer, I still feel that Spurs will be bracing themselves for a lot of interest in their manager. Mm. I think it will go back to this age-old question, can one of those superpowers appoint a manager who's yet to win a trophy? And I get that, but those clubs see what he's done as a modern manager in progressing a club, in progressing players, embracing the young talent, playing a certain very attractive, stylish way. Mm. But I would also argue that it's important that for Pochettino and his players' sake to win something this season. Because if you don't have that kind of focal point of silverware, how do you keep those players motivated and interested, you know, moving forward? I do think it's an issue for some of those players. They're not going to win the Premier League. No. I think they're Champions League outsiders, rank outsiders, let's be honest. So, you know,
does he pick a strong team against Arsenal?
I would. I really
would. He probably
would.
Won't, will he?
No, he won't. He'll rest and rotate. Yeah. But I would also think he'll probably match up with Arsenal. Although I would argue that Tottenham, if you look at what they've done, it's slightly stronger than what Arsenal, you know, sort of their backup team.
Will the defeat, though, in the Premier League and all the, you know, attendant, you know, North London's red and all that stuff that came out, do you think that will push him?
Well, it might do, but he's probably more level-headed than that, to be honest. He won't go with his emotions. I worry that he might go too pragmatic and pick a much weakened team with an eye on the weekend. I think he should go out and try and win this competition with his strongest team, just to get that monkey off his back. Just you know, he'll have won a trophy. OK, it's the League Cup, and then we'll all turn around and say, we've only won the League Cup. But it's better than winning nothing. I mean, it's still... We always go back to Mourinho's first trophy in English football. That was the League Cup, wasn't it? The win over Liverpool. And it sort of paved the way. The players got used to winning things. Sort of the mentality of the football club got raised as a result. So I'd like him to go, but I suspect he won't let his heart rule his head, and he'll end up playing a more pragmatic team with a view to the weekend fixture. Mm-hmm.
How urgently do Spurs need to get out of Wembley?
Oh, I mean, it can't come
soon enough. They have to queue up the tube, you know, like everybody else.
I mean, honestly, I love Wembley because of childhood memories and kind of you go
love
there.
Or loved?
Loved. Mm. And I honestly, the more I think about it, the more I cannot believe that the Wembley sale didn't go through, by the way. What an absolute gift that would have been if someone's prepared to make a £1 billion deal, because that's what it is, you know, after the actual sale of the stadium, plus the value of the club Wembley business, for example, give that away just to be leaseholders, basically, of a shell, of a stadium. I mean, it's just ridiculous. That stadium will need serious upgrading. The transport links already look horribly, horribly badly placed.
Pitch is terrible.
Pitch is terrible. Fans don't like going there. They'll suffer it once or twice a season. Of course they will, because they associate going there with winning silverware. You know, as I always thought, associate it with big England games or basically going there to watch a spectacular final. You don't want to go there week in, week out. And I just feel so sorry for Spurs fans, because they kind of get all this stick for not going to games. Well, they didn't sign up for this when they bought the season ticket. I think certain lessons could be learned, you know, from Spurs' point of view about kind of... I know it's only sort of kind of token ideas, but look at what Leicester did under their wonderful deceased now chairman. You know, just giving tokens for a pint of beer or a pie. Things, silly things like that. Just keep the fans on side with what
it's
the club is doing.
They're going to have an amazing home. Just
it
come
is.
Up with it for
and no, 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 time. Don't get me wrong, Dom. I do think that basically, I mean, listen, I don't live a million miles away from the new ground, and I'm so passionate about where they stay, so please don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it's a vote of faith in the local community.
Absolutely. Yeah. But all I mean to say is what I think Spurs should have done from the off was saying it's going to be 2 years.
Yeah.
And basically, once you've done that, I think the Spurs fans...
The PR's been terrible.
Spurs fans, I think...
No transparency.
No, absolutely. I think that's an issue.
But I think Spurs fans will think, OK, a bit of short...
They don't. Pain. Well, they're annoyed at the moment.
Give it 2 more years, 3 more years.
Hope so.
They'll forget this.
It's interesting. Stuff's beginning to filter out. You know, obviously, there was that sort of promotional event at the stadium at the weekend. What sort of feedback are you getting from that?
Honestly, I know someone who went and basically said it was absolutely fantastic. And I've been to the ground recently just to see the outside. And honestly, it's like a spaceship coming from outer space. It looks fantastic. And I think it's great that they've stayed in the area. you know, because it is a downtrodden, underdeveloped, underprivileged area of London, one of the worst areas of London, make no mistakes about that, in terms of it, you know, being impoverished. And I think it's great that they've stayed in the area. It can transform that particular part of London. And I just think in 2 or 3 years, we will long have forgotten this Wembley farce. But I just think it's been... I just think a better idea would have said it's going to take us 2 years to build one of the best, if not the best, stadium in Europe. Mm-hmm. Bear with us. And they would have done that. But the kind of the farce about the sort of the elongated second season, yeah. that's the thing that's tough to swallow. But this stadium will be sensational.
OK, let's look at Arsenal, Dom, if we may. Lost the unbeaten record at Southampton. One or two, you know, mitigating factors, you know, you had... Xhaka at centre-half alongside, you know, Koscielny, who's been out for, what, 6 months. What do we read into that performance? And is it just one of those things where, you know, the law of averages evened out?
Yeah, I think so. I know it's going to sound ridiculous, but I do think that of all unbeaten runs, a 22-match unbeaten run, it was probably one of the least convincing unbeaten runs. Fantastic that Unai Emery was able to instigate that and to maintain it as long as he did. But there have been signs over that run where they've been straining to keep afloat. And look, I think everybody is impressed with the impact that he's made already. But everybody also, including himself, really realistic about where Arsenal are. I'd say they're probably one place higher than they thought they would be. They probably thought they'd be beneath Manchester United in the table. Fifth place at the moment feels progressive. Mm. OK, they got done at the weekend and he must be infuriated that he lost to a team that don't win at home and have struggled for goals all season. But then you look at the three headers that were scored, and that was just because they had such a makeshift back line with players who were semi-fit, players who were playing out of position. It's almost understandable and forgivable that happened. They will look at it as a missed opportunity, obviously, because Southampton were potentially there for the taking. But the circumstances around it, new manager in charge and the fact that Arsenal were so depleted, you know, get over that, move on. They've got a chance in midweek to put that right. If they beat Tottenham, the supporter base will be happy and in fact, they'll be ecstatic.
You think they've got a chance, Arsenal?
Against Tottenham? Yeah, I think it's a bit of a lottery, this one, because I don't think either side is going to put out a completely full-strength team. It's a really interesting dynamic for Arsenal because on the back of a defeat, I do think that makes Arsenal think, oh, should we take this one a little bit more seriously? Because if top four's slipping away... And once you kind of lose focus of those games and maybe sort of change your focus a little bit, I think that's when danger creeps in. You know, they've got a crowded fixture schedule as well, haven't they? Because it's Wednesday night, then obviously Burnley at the weekend, the early game. And it's... I think there's a bit of balancing act because I think some of those players... He trains them hard, by the way, Emery. Mm. Works them hard. And I'm not being critical, but it's just... I think sometimes you've seen at various stretch points during that run, particularly, obviously, on Sunday at Southampton, when they're struggling for players, struggling for bodies, particularly sort of amid suspensions, perhaps, then I think you can maybe see that sort of fatigue creep in when players perhaps need that rest. And I think the progress he's made has been absolutely remarkable. Emery, I just think it's way beyond, you know, what was expected. But, I mean, he'll make himself a goal if they can beat Spurs twice in a row, but I do think it's a big ask.
Yeah. What about Chelsea, Dom? You watched Hazard. Scored his first goal since October. He looks to me to be a player who's almost on permanent audition for the big move. Is that right?
I think he'll go to Real Madrid. Permanent. I don't think he needs to audition anymore. He's found it difficult of late. And I think he benefited on Sunday from an uncharacteristically tentative performance from Brighton through the first 60 minutes. I think Chelsea potentially were there for the taking. If Brighton had started the game like they finished it, then it would have been really tight. But I think that they were a bit scarred from maybe what happened last year when Hazard, Willian and Pedro had just completely run riot and cut through them. I think there were flashes of that in that first half. He was irresistible yesterday. I mean, absolutely stunning display as ever. But they did give him the time and sort of held off him because they obviously remember what he did to them last year. And he'll do that against
teams of that stature. He'll do it against most of the teams in the Premier League. It's, you know, we want to see him. In fairness, he had 2 assists against Manchester City the previous week. But, I mean, look, he's a player that isn't comfortable in that number nine position. He's sort of filling in. But unfortunately, he's now playing so well in that position, he may end up there for the long term. We're now getting Sarri sort of making those worrying comments about, oh, he could be really important for us in the number nine. Well, he doesn't want to play that. He wants to play on the left. He wants to have the sort of free role he had in the first couple of months of Sarri's tenure. Look, ultimately, I do think he'll probably move on. I think it's telling that Chelsea have made it known to him for ages that there's a contract on the table if he wants to sign it. He hasn't signed it.
You saw Giroud last week, interviewed him. Comes across really well. Give us your impression.
Just intelligent, grounded, still pinching himself to be a World Cup winner. Ambitious still. He talked about still wanting to win the Premier League, which surprised me because he's 32, coming up to the last 6 months of his contract at Chelsea. To have that level of ambition, having just won the World Cup, I thought was quite striking. I think he'll be remembered fondly by, will certainly be remembered fondly by Arsenal, and I think he will be remembered fondly by Chelsea when he goes. I think he's done a brilliant job in the Premier League and quite often not as a first-choice striker. I mean, Arsenal, there were periods where he was first-choice, but generally speaking, he was even competing with Alexis Sanchez for that central role, wasn't he? I mean,
yeah, he was sort of kind of, for the vast majority, he was definitely first-choice, but I just think that there was always this question mark over basic whether he'd score goals in the big games. But I always thought he was a fantastic character in the dressing room. You know, fantastic servant for the club. I mean, he's the most English centre-forward, bearing in mind doesn't come from England, you could ever wish to see. You know, absolutely fantastic, sort of in the air, strong, powerful. He would score goals. Yeah. Decent tally of basic assists and also goals, much more importantly. You know, it's amazing to think he's only got, you know, I'd have forgotten that. He's only got 6 months left.
They gave him an 18-month contract. Oh. I suspect they will. That will be something that gets renewed, given the sort of uncertainty that's hanging over Chelsea and the transfer windows and potential FIFA bans, etc. It would be crazy to let him go. And he is a player that made it very obvious in the interview that he doesn't want to leave. He loves living in London. He likes the sort of family atmosphere that he's found at Chelsea. He liked it at Arsenal as well.
Do you think there's any disappointment in the basic, the fact that, let's be honest, he left Arsenal because he thought he'd be on the bench? He's left Arsenal's bench for Chelsea's bench.
Yeah, he's quite realistic about the situation he found himself in at the beginning of this season because he came back late after the World Cup. So he was accepting of the fact that Alvaro Morata started the season in the team. I think his frustration will be now that Hazard is playing ahead of both of them as a number nine. He will see off the challenge of Morata. I think Morata will be sold at some point, probably in the summer, and go back to Spain. But Giroud would have hoped by then he has been a regular in that starting 11 for the second half of the season. And if he is, he'll score 10 goals between January and the end of the season because he is that type of player. Mm. He brings the best out of Hazard as well. We shouldn't be forgotten that goal yesterday was the first time that Hazard had scored in the Premier League this season without Giroud on the pitch.
Tom, you're a very close observer of Chelsea. You mentioned there about the potential UEFA action, possible partial closure of the ground because of the anti-Semitic chanting. Given the nature of the owner, Roman Abramovich being Jewish, what impact has that had or will that have on the football club itself and how damaging could it be?
Look, potentially it could be really damaging. I don't know whether UEFA will punish Chelsea. There are suggestions that maybe the officials on the pitch didn't hear the chants, but the club were aware of them because the club issued the statement. The club from
top and to be fair to them, they've been proactive, haven't
they? Oh, absolutely. And that sums up. On this issue, Chelsea, they feel passionately about this from top to bottom at that club. You saw Bruce Buck outside the away end at the Amex Stadium on Sunday, sort of talking to anyone who'll talk to him and basically just reminding people of their responsibilities and sort of the world is watching this Chelsea support at the moment. I know that there's a sense of why are they picking on us within that Chelsea support, but the reality is that last week was dismal for Chelsea as the image of the club. It was absolutely appalling. From the Manchester City game to what happened in Budapest, and I'm talking also about what happened in the city centre at Budapest, away from the ground with the banners and the images of which appeared on social media. That is damaging, and I don't think Abramovich will put up with it. We've often wondered about in recent times about Abramovich and his commitment to Chelsea because of the visa issues and the fact that he's now an Israeli citizen rather than, you know, and he's not spent any time at Chelsea. He's not been to Chelsea this calendar year, as far as I'm aware, to watch a game. This is the type of issue that he feels so passionately about that he will be willing to disassociate himself from the club over it. And that has massive, massive implications for Chelsea. The idiots who are singing these songs need to shut up and realise the damage they're doing.
There is a mood now for open debate. And I think, you know, we talked a lot on the show last week about Raheem Sterling and the positive nature of his contribution. Are we at a tipping point for these issues?
Well, I think it's good that we're even talking about it because, you know, let's be honest, it's something that kind of maybe happens in an isolated incident and then doesn't crop up again. But I do think what I get the impression is that basically people are determined to seize this moment. I think that's a really, really good thing because it's put it in the spotlight. And I think Raheem Sterling then using that platform that he had last week to maybe kind of, you know, highlight differences in the media treatment, for example. But then it also kind of makes it a sort of a wider issue, doesn't it? Which I think was also excellent, that maybe, hopefully, makes fans think twice. Then you've got Raheem Sterling sort of being the front of a very thought-provoking Nike campaign. Then you've got the Premier League sort of effectively issuing this sort of guidelines about kind of almost, let's be honest here, shop a racist, isn't it? You know, in conjunction with Kick It Out. And I think it's the fact that they're trying to sort of kind of seize on this opportunity is a good thing. I was worried at sort of at various points last week that almost this weekend just gone was going to go by without some sort of opportunity taken. And I think the fact then that the sort of the Premier League did do something, were proactive, it was interesting that they announced it on Friday afternoon, bearing in mind what had happened Thursday night, albeit in a different competition. Mm. But they're obviously aware and acutely aware, and that basically I think it would have been embarrassing not to do anything. And I think football must learn quickly, you know, sort of lessons about this. Because we're not just talking about kind of racist abuse. I see the hate sort of kind of etched on some of those fans that give opposition players abuse. I mean, really? You know, it's just like they're in the entertainment business and it's just on every level, it's abhorrent. And so hopefully, I do think that this feels like a moment in time and it feels like a really important moment in time.
Yeah, well, I think the debate is passionate and it's insightful. But we've got to draw this to a close. I suppose we better get back to where we began with the Champions League draw. Simple question to finish with. Who's your winner?
Well, Manchester City are the bookies' favourites. And I'd have to say, you never know quite how it's going to shape up. But I just feel that they've got the best opportunity of not just the Premier League teams, but I look across Europe and who are they up against? Who are the best teams from the foreign countries? I think they could overcome Juventus, who are arguably the best team out of Italy. Barcelona the same. Real Madrid, obviously, you know, the holders. But I think City are better than all of those superpowers. So I would say Man City for me would be my choice as favourites.
Dom?
Yeah, I'd go City, but I think Juventus would push them really, really hard.
Well, let's face it, City bought Pep in to win the Champions League. It's payback time. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.